Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 89. Bringing you authors of science fiction and fantasy, publishing industry analysis, writing tips, book reviews, and the occasional belly laugh.
World while you were gone.
Nice segue there, Sean.
It's Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Oh yeah, we're brilliant.
Yeah, if you need a really, really tall blonde person, I'm your woman.
This is Lou Anders, editorial director of Pirate Book.
This is Tracy Hickman.
This is Sean Williams.
And now, your host. And welcome to another episode of Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. I'm your host, Sean Farrell. Well, hello, happy 2010, everybody. I think this is the first show of the new year, so it's not even a new year anymore. And I have my son on my lap here, so I have no idea what he's going to say or do while we're recording, but this is going to be short and sweet. So in an attempt to make up for the lack of content that we've had in 2010, I have three interviews for you today. One is with Joshua Belmas of the Jabberwocky Literary Agency, and then we have interviews with two authors, Peter V. Brett and John Sprunk. And all of these interviews were done by Jonathan Schieffer at the World Fantasy Convention last year. So please, drop by the website and give a shout-out to Jonathan if you haven't done that already, because we sure appreciate the hard work he did on all these great interviews that he put together for us. Is that right? Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. So I'm going to get going short and sweet here, and hopefully we'll have more content for you soon. Thank you so much. And until next time, enjoy the interviews, keep reading. And Connor, can you say bye-bye?
Bye-bye. Oh, to hugging.
That's right.
I am sitting with Joshua Belmas, agent at Jabberwocky Agency.
Yes.
Tell me about Jabberwocky.
Well, we've been around Jabberwocky, actually celebrating its 15th anniversary this fall.
Wow.
I had worked at a larger agency, the Scott Meredith Literary Agency, which in its heyday had been the leading agent for SF Fantasy, now really not there other than to collect checks anymore. But I'd been there for 8 years before I went out on my own. Our top clients include Charlaine Harris, Brandon Sanderson, Peter Brett, Elizabeth Moon, Simon Green, Kat Richardson, and Tanya Huff in the SF fantasy genre, and many others.
Do you specialize in science fiction fantasy, or...?
Pretty much. I do have an associate agent, Eddie Schneider, who's moving into, YA and middle grade that may not necessarily be so much SF fantasy. I've also always loved mystery novels, and as an example, Charlaine Harris is known now for her Sookie Stackhouse vampire books, but before that, I had, sold many books of hers in the mystery genre where she came out of. So we do a little work there and a little bit of horror, like the Dark Delicacies anthology series. But most of the business is in science fiction and fantasy for us.
So you mentioned the Meredith Agency.
Yes.
How did you become an agent?
When I was in high school, I wrote critique letters every month to Stan Schmidt at Analog. Betsy Mitchell, who is now at Del Rey, was then his associate editor. So she was reading all of these letters as they passed through the pipeline, and she was hired away in like late 1983 or early 84 to help start up Bain Books. And from reading these letters, she decided that I would be a good person to try out for doing freelance kinds of things. Readers' reports are in-office work of all kinds of shapes and sizes for Bain. So I did that in the summer of 1984, and it was kind of like love at first sight with being in the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. When I graduated college a little bit later, ending up as an agent was really, you know, the luck of the draw. The first job offer I got hunting after college was at the Scott Meredith Agency. So wow. That was the part of the business I ended up in. And, 23 years later, it's what I'm still doing.
That's wild. So was your education in marketing or English? Or?
No. I started out in physics in college. My fourth semester in, I had no comprehension of Fourier series, and a professor whose assistance consisted of, there's a really good section on that in the textbook. And I also ran into a real roadblock in intermediate electromagnetism, which I got like a C minus in or something like that, which was like five grades lower than pretty much anything else I did in college. So I decided after that semester that physics was not going to work for me, and I became a history major, and that's what I ended up in. In terms of the marketing stuff, honestly, a lot of that is learning from people. At the Scott Meredith Agency, like one office over from me was Russell Galen, who was another leading agent in the field. I could learn a lot just by listening to his phone calls. And just kind of good or bad, being there for 8 years and thinking of things that I really liked, how they were doing it, and things where I thought the Scott Meredith Agency wasn't doing stuff as well as it could. And I said, you know, if I'm ever running the place, this is what we do better.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are a lot of people who believe that that in order to be a successful agent, you got to be in New York, where you're located. Do you feel that that's the case, or...?
That's never been 100% the case. And there are a lot of successful agents who are not based out of New York. I personally think that the biggest obstacle to being a successful agent outside of New York is that you may need to at least have started off in New York. A colleague of mine, like, let's say, Lucien Diver, who's based in Florida now, mm-hmm. you know, she was in New York for a long time, and she was able to make contacts, and that being the case, I think it's more than possible to kind of keep up with the business by going to conventions, going to New York maybe once or twice a year and doing a series of meetings. I don't know how easy it is to be an agent based outside of New York who's never in New York, mm-hmm. because there's still an element of interpersonal relationship to the business that you need to get somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I read on your website that you guys do a lot of work with authors in improving the manuscripts you got, and Peter Brett said the same thing. That's pretty time consuming, and I've heard that a lot of the agents nowadays and editors don't do that as much.
Yeah, it's certainly true at publishing houses. Many fewer of them look at unsolicited manuscripts now than 20 years ago when I was starting in the business. At the same time, I think most every agent or editor has to be willing to invest sometimes in working with an author, because you can't expect perfection to just, you know, show up on your desk all the time. But I do certainly think that editorial work is a particular strength of our agency. I've always had a really good eye for people who are not yet at perfection, but you can kind of see the spark that's there. And Peter Brett is a good example of that. Brandon Sanderson is an author who wrote 13 novels before selling what was his sixth or seventh. And I did not read all 13 of those, but I certainly read three or four of them on the way to the first that actually sold. Mm. And it was just this sense, like with Brandon, he had plotting troubles, particularly in his earliest novels, but the magic systems were always so inventive and creative, and there was a different one in each novel that I was reading. Mm. And since so many fantasy writers kind of get one idea and drag it out through a 15-book series or something, the fact that I was looking at somebody who was in his mid-20s and kept on coming at me with new, fresh, interesting, creative magic systems told me, you know, you want to be working with this person, and there will be a payoff to it. And it doesn't always work out that way, but I've had enough good calls on this that, you know, that, as I said, I just think I do have a particularly good eye for that. Mm.
From everyone I spoke to, Brandon seems to have a prodigious output.
Yes.
Of quality work.
Yes.
How common is his output for...
He's certainly at the high end output-wise. You know, most authors actually do have a kind of schedule on which they can write a book. Mm-hmm. The publishing industry would always like that schedule to be once every 12 months. Mm-hmm. Creatively, it simply isn't that way. You know, so you have an author like Brandon who can write hundreds of thousands of words of really good fantasy every year. Peter Brett is certainly not at that pace, probably won't be. Simon Green is able to write like one big Secret Histories book and a smaller Nightside book and do that pretty consistently year in, year out. Another author, I'd say that it's around every 14 months that Elizabeth Moon is able to write a book. So people actually have a schedule that over a period of many years can be pretty consistent. There's always a problem as the publishing industry comes to grips with what the author's actual schedule is. You know, so like with Peter Brett, as he's actually written the second book, the publishers have started to recognize, you know, it will not be every 12 months right. that we have one to publish. Elizabeth Moon is an interesting case because 14 months is so close to 12 that the publishers generally publish her every 12 books, but then every third or fourth book, you just can't do that.
Right.
And all of a sudden, you will have a year and a half or a two-year gap between books. And then they'll publish them every 12 books for a while. And then you'll have another big gap.
Mm. Mm. We talked about editing a moment ago. What would you say some of the roles that an agent plays for an author? Publishing.
Yeah. An agent does many things. They're not always the same with every agent, and not every author wants the same thing out of an agent. You know, some people simply want to get the best deal they can. And there are agents who are very good at, like, whatever the book, getting the best possible deal for that.
Right.
Some people really want an agent who will be an editor to them. And then I've had some clients who have told me kind of like, editor, edit, agent, agent. And really don't want so much of that role from their agent. But you're looking at a lot of things from finding the book, finding the publishers, negotiating a contract, giving long-term career guidance, being there if a problem pops up, hand-holding you if you find yourself on your third editor for your first novel, selling foreign rights to your work, selling film and TV rights or audio rights, looking at royalty statements when they come in. There are just a lot of different roles that an agent can help fill for you.
You mentioned hand-holding, and without naming names, because I really wouldn't want to do that, what are some of the common crises you've faced with authors and or editors, or do you not feel comfortable?
No, I mean, definitely one of the biggest crises you face is your editor leaves, and you suddenly have a new editor, which may not always happen at a propitious time. So that's a difficult situation. Your publisher deciding to drop you is a difficult situation. Realizing that you're going to be 8 months late on your book. Those are all examples of a situation where you may really need to be there for somebody. And authors are also human. They're trying to do their work amidst everything else in their life, and sometimes they need a voice because there's trouble with their day job, or they have a parent who's, a dying, or a family member who's sick, or something like that, and you might just be helping to provide a kind of kind voice at the other end of the phone line.
Generally, it seems from when I was reading your client list, your author list, that a lot of your authors aren't really involved in new media, with the exception of Brandon Sanderson. Is that correct? And how do you feel about that?
Well, it depends on how you define new media. Most of my clients have a website.
Yeah.
A lot of them do blogging. Twittering, some of them do. So almost all of my authors are in some way using the technologies that have developed over the years I've been in the business. On the other hand, if, like, you mean, is there a video game or that kind of thing, well, it's not entirely the author's choice.
Right.
You might need a partner who will actually be doing that. I don't see my clients as somehow being removed from the rest of the wide world, with a few exceptions. Simon Green perhaps doesn't really have a website or a live journal or anything like that. He's probably the only of my clients who isn't out there in some way doing things.
Related to this, there's a lot of talk lately about publishing not doing as much promotion for authors, and that authors having to do a lot of promotion themselves. Now, I don't know if this is a change in the industry, or if this is the way it's always been, or if just the landscape is so nebulous right now that nobody's sure What do you think about that?
By and large, it is the way it has always been. Publishers simply don't have, bottomless pockets, and they have to make choices on where they're going to put their staff and their time and their money. And, almost any book that comes out is at some level under merchandise. Mm-hmm. It's been that way for the entire time that I have been in the business. Now, that being said, publishers themselves have certainly been exploring a lot of different things, like whether it's helping an author with a web page or doing online media campaigns or giving out free ebook editions or free sample chapters or putting up video on Savudu or Tor.com or things like that. Publishers have certainly been trying to find ways to use new technology to try and get more out of the same or perhaps even shrinking budgets and staff resources.
What, with that in mind, what would you say the ideal means and mechanisms of the current or upcoming writer would be for self-promotion?
There's a big menu of things to choose from, and there isn't any one that's going to be the right thing for every author. Just about any kind of thing you can do, somebody has done it successfully, and somebody has done it, and it's been a complete waste. Kari Doctorow and I could probably have a nice argument or debate or whatever about whether giving away free ebooks is worthwhile. He is a huge proponent of this. I have found that most of the time when publishers have done it for my authors, they've just been giving something away and really not getting anything out of it in return. Both of us are right and both of us are wrong, and and a lot of it is situational.
I asked your junior agent Eddie Schneider this question, and I'd like to hear your opinion. Describe the hypothetical dream client for you.
I think the most important thing for an author is to be self-aware. If I'm looking at a query letter, it's one of the things I look for in terms of the background information the author's provided, how they've summarized their work, is if they show some sign of self-awareness. And I think the dream client then is somebody who is aware of where they are in the industry, which does not mean that they cannot wish to and cannot push us that they should be in a better place, but that they are aware of where they are, mm-hmm. what it implies for them, what it implies for their career. And, honestly, it also helps if the client is somebody you enjoy being around. Mm. And, of course, since personalities are different, even something as simple as that can mean a lot of things to a lot of different people. But definitely self-awareness. And I certainly put a lot of effort into telling a client what's up. So, if a publisher drops an author, it shouldn't ever come as a surprise to myself mm-hmm. or the author that this is happening.
There's been a lot of talk lately about the changing landscape of publishing. What do you think that the future of publishing looks like?
You know, that's... I'm not good at predicting nobody whom I've spoken to really is. There was this sense almost even before I started my own agency 15 years ago that the ebook revolution was on the horizon. And yes, it has finally arrived, and it's arrived 10 years later than the earliest and most ardent supporters would have told us, and at the same time, in some ways, much sooner than I would have thought even 2 years ago, before the Kindle and the Sony Reader, the idea that we would be where we were now seemed actually pretty distant 2 years ago. So it's very hard to say. The one thing I worry about the most is file sharing, because that's what killed the music industry. There are plenty of file sharing and download sites that are just blatantly providing free reproduction of copyrighted material without any real concern to themselves that they're doing this in publishing. The one difference between us and the music industry, I guess, is on the good side, there isn't this pent-up feeling of dissatisfaction with publishing, where everyone always kind of thought that an album costed too much. You know, why did a CD cost as much as an album when the actual costs, I mean, by album meaning vinyl, when the actual costs of the CD were so much less? And you had a lot of built-up frustration. We don't have that in publishing, so maybe people will feel less like they can do whatever they want and it's just giving them what they deserve. On the other hand, we don't have tours. We don't have t-shirts. We don't have ringtones. We don't have all of these other sources of ancillary revenue that have kicked in for the music industry. So in a if the publishing industry would become like the music industry, you would have to come to World Fantasy, pay extra for each panel you wanted to go to, and the organizers of the convention would then have to divvy up that money so the attending authors could actually make a living doing this. That's not going to happen. So we have to hope that whatever happens with ebooks, it is not going to become, I will just take what I want and not pay for it, and it really isn't hurting anybody.
Are you and or Eddie looking for new clients?
Eddie is certainly looking for new clients. I have come to the realization in recent months that at the moment it is a real challenge for me because, you know, happily, I guess, I have authors like Shalane Harris and Brandon Sanderson and Peter Brett who have just really taken off and who, you know, it's a lot of work. And that has hurt my reading pile. And it doesn't seem fair to say, to tell something, I'd love to see your manuscript when I know I'm not going to read it for 8 months. I would love to find a way to get back more on top of things where I can be looking a little more. And nobody is ever not looking, period. But certainly for us, Eddie is the much more active acquirer of new talent than I am right now.
What would be the best way for a new aspiring writer aspiring to be published to contact you or Eddie?
Well, I mean, the best thing to do is send us a really good query letter via the old-fashioned mail. and attract our attention. You know, we get them, we look at them, and we find authors that way. And obviously, networking is really important as well. So if you have an opportunity to go to a writer's conference or a convention where you can meet the editors and the publishers and the agents who are working in the field you were in, that is always something you should try and take advantage of.
Such as World Fantasy.
Definitely such as World Fantasy, yes.
Have you or Eddie spoken to anybody at World Fantasy that you've solicited manuscripts from?
Yes, I mean, I guess, you know, certainly there are people we've met whom we have said, yes, we would like to see something of yours. Mm-hmm. You know, my breakfast this morning was with Tim Akers, who is an author that I met at World Fantasy in Madison, and I asked to see a manuscript, and that is not the manuscript that ended up becoming his first novel, but it was a manuscript that told me Tim Akers was an author I wanted to be keeping in contact with.
Hmm. You mentioned your website, awfulagent.com. .com.
Yes.
And that's where to find Jabberwocky on the
that's
web.
That's where to find us.
Thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you, Jonathan.
We have been speaking with Joshua Bilmes, senior agent at Jabberwocky Agency. I am sitting with Peter V. Brett, author of The Warded Man.
Also known as The Painted Man internationally.
That book, I couldn't put it down.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
I never get tired of hearing that.
It blew me away. I was nervous about the interviews I was going to be doing, but then I read yours, and I read Tim Akers' Heart of Veridon, and I was just like, I get to talk to these people.
I was just having dinner with Tim Akers not 2 hours ago. He's sitting right across from me. We're both at the same literary agency.
Yeah, that's how I found you.
He's a great guy.
Yeah. Tell me about The Warded Man.
The Warded Man is a project that I've been working on for many years. I started it as a homework assignment in a science fiction writing class that I was taking at New York School of Continuing Education. I got out of college with a degree in English, wanting very much to be a writer, but I needed to eat, so I instead got a job as an editor for a medical publishing company. I was working as an editor for several years and doing production work, but I never gave up on wanting to be a writer, and I was always writing at night and in my spare time. I was running D&D campaigns where I would write, fill notebooks and notebooks with plots and intricacies that the players never saw or cared about, but I loved writing it. So I took this writing class, and one of the assignments, they broke down a lot of things about fantasy writing, and the professor had said the one thing that he asked is, don't bring any of your old work to this class. Anything that you do in class should be new. Don't try and hand in anything that you wrote previously hoping for a critique. And I took that to heart. So we were given a homework assignment to write the first chapter to a new fantasy novel.
Mm-hmm.
And I put it off until the last minute, as I was wont to do with homework assignments. And when I sat down and wrote it, I wrote this short little story about a young boy named Arlen who had wanderlust and loved to wander the countryside, but he could never go more than half a day from his home because he had to turn back and be back home in time before the sunset, because when the sun set, the demons came out.
Mm.
And if you weren't home behind the protective symbols that were drawn around the house, you were essentially dead.
Mm-hmm.
He would sit and look out his window and watch the demons and wonder what lay over that next hill that was half a day away from his house.
Mm-hmm.
And he promised himself that one day he would go find out even if it meant spending a night outside with the demons. And as I said, I knocked that story out in one night. I turned it in. The teacher kind of ripped it up. And I was working on another project at the time, and I put it aside, and I kind of didn't work on it for a while, but I was always, it was always tickling the back of my head. I wanted to know what was over the next hill, too, and I wanted to help Arlen find it. That short story became the prologue to the Painted Man, which eventually was renamed The Warded Man. And it stayed with the book until after it had sold internationally. My French publisher loved that prologue so much that they're the, that's the only version right now that includes that little scene. But the U.S. version cut it out and started fresh with the first chapter. The book is a labor of love.
One of the things, and there are quite a few aspects that I want to get into, one of the things that I absolutely loved is your use of technology. More to the point, lack of technology. You specifically go into the smaller towns not having glass, and then Arlen being amazed when he first sees glass. How did you come up with that? Like, what kinds of technologies didn't they have? What kind of research did you do?
Well, it's not coming from a place of history. It's coming from the concept behind the story is that demons used to essentially rule the earth until a man known as the Deliverer came and united humanity and invented a magic that was able to harm the demons, because the demons are creatures of magic. They're immortal. They're immune to normal weapons for the most part. They're essentially unkillable without the aid of magic. And so approximately 3,000 years before the book takes place, the Deliverer united humanity in war against the demons, and they were winning. The demons were reduced to almost nothing. But then one night, the demons didn't come out. They just stopped coming. And humanity believed that they were gone. They thought that they had won the war. And as years passed and the demons never came back, people began to forget. And so the magic that had united humanity was now useless, because it was only useful against demons.
Right.
And so science took the place of that, and humanity reached a place of great technology and power, but the magic was now relegated to fairy tales, and no one believed in demons anymore. And you know, after thousands of years, it was just considered a fairy tale. So humanity was utterly unprepared when the demons came back after breeding for 3,000 years. They returned in force and destroyed the libraries, destroyed the power sources, destroyed the electrical plants, things like that. And human civilization collapsed practically overnight. The weapons that were so useful in killing other humans were useless in killing demons. And by the time people rediscovered the magic that had been relegated to the children's fairy tale section of the library, only a few people were left. And because the demons would come out every night, travel became very difficult.
Right.
You had to be home behind your wards before the demons came out. The few pockets of humanity that were left became more and more isolated and more concerned with just surviving.
Right.
And so all of their technology kind of faded away. You couldn't do the you couldn't mine or do the things that we need to do to support our technology, because as soon as the sun went down, the demons would show up and tear it all apart. That it was that kind of oppression that I wanted to show, and to show that, that humanity had lost almost everything and were reduced to cowering in fear every night. It was the theme of fear that was the thing that I really wanted to address in the story, and to put humanity in a very weak position as the story opens.
So you use the progression, the apparent progression of technology or lack thereof, as a sign of the demon's basic reign over humanity.
Yeah, that they had taken everything that humans had built and torn it down, and so the story kind of is the story of humanity clawing its way back from the brink of extinction.
Another thing that you did very sparingly but well is dialect. You used only a few places where where the characters, I think Arlen's father was one of them. It was reminiscent of a Mark Twain, almost, kind of vernacular.
Because all of the I call them the free cities, or the major walled cities where humans still live in relative safety, and there were also a lot of smaller farming hamlets that were necessary to produce enough food for everyone to survive. Because these places were so isolated, I made a real effort to change the speech patterns from place to place. Mm-hmm. So even in the different small towns, there's subtle differences in the way people address each other, the types of slang and contractions they use. And there are also a lot of words that were exclusive to this setting overall. A lot of the curse words would involve nighttime, mm-hmm. or demons or the core, which is the place where they believe demons come from. So I have extensive notes on how people speak in each different town.
Wow.
The opening town, Tibbetts Brook, is fashioned very much on the American Old West in some ways. To me, it kind of has like a Little House on the Prairie feel. I think you can see some of that in the dialect there, but in the different cities and towns, people speak differently, and I try to make that clear to show that things are isolated and they're evolving in their own way in those different places.
Mm. You follow three main viewpoints. Obviously, Arlen is one, though it's in third person. What made you choose three, and did that evolve just as naturally as Arlen did?
Well, in the original, there were two drafts of the book. The first draft I wrote probably around 2005. I finished it, give or take. I'm not sure right now. And I tried to sell that draft. And I took it to my current agent, Joshua Bilmes. So I had submitted the manuscript to Joshua, and he rejected it. And I was very disheartened by that, and I actually put the book aside and worked on some other projects. That draft was exclusively in Arlen's point of view.
Okay.
The entire thing from beginning to end was in Arlen's point of view. What I discovered after putting it down for a little while and coming back to it with a fresh eye was that the character of Arlen is a very lonely one. His struggle to overcome his fear of the night and overcome his guilt over some events early in his life that scarred him drive him to go and travel the world alone, trying to seek the lost magic that allowed humans to fight back against demons. And I discovered that when your character is alone all the time, it doesn't always make for compelling storytelling. and it also it made him seem lonely and bitter in a way that I think made the book hard to relate to.
Mm-hmm.
So in the original draft, the two I don't want to call them backup dancers, but Roger and Leisha. He meets them at towards the very end of the book, pretty much in the same way that he meets them in the final published novel. And I always knew their backstories, but they weren't told in their own point of view. It was always in Arlen's point of view.
Right.
What I decided to do, I threw away about 60% of that draft.
Wow.
And started fresh on it.
So it was about the same length as your present final work.
About. And but in the time that I had set it aside, I had learned a lot about writing, and when I went back to it, I saw the flaws that were in it, and I decided to fix them by giving a voice to those two other characters and showing where they came from, and using it as a way to expand the world and show more of what was going on in different places and give the reader an idea of how people are struggling all over this world. And so the concept became to take all three of these characters from childhood, show how each of them had been scarred by a demon encounter very early in their life, and how that set them on a course that led them to confront their fear of the night, and each of them finds their own way to fight back and to resist the demons. And when that clicked in my head, the first draft had taken me many, many years to write. When I realized that, I had the second draft done in about a year.
Wow.
And resubmitted that to my agent, fully expecting him to reject that too. When you write by yourself, you really have no idea what other people are going to think about it. And I'm very private about it. I wasn't showing it to a lot of people. So I submitted it and I held my breath. And a couple of weeks later, I got a phone call from him, and he said that it was the best book that he'd read all year, and that he would be thrilled to represent it. And I'm still kind of shocked at that, and the subsequent success has amazed me as much as anyone.
Yeah. So, as a total, how long were you working on The Warded Man?
It was
The Painted Man first.
From the moment I wrote that little short story to the moment the book sold was about 7.5 years.
Wow.
And it was never far from my mind in that period. There were times when I would... When you're an aspiring writer, you have all the time in the world. Mm-hmm. So you can write for a while and then say, oh, I've come up with a problem and I don't know how to fix it. I'm going to put the manuscript down for a couple of months and come back to it later.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were long periods when I didn't write. There were periods when I was romancing my wife or doing other things and taking care of life things and not working. But even when I was doing those things, the story was never far from my mind. I was always writing down notes about the currency system in one city, or how another group of people would talk, or ways that people would resist the demons, or just little world-building things that built up over time to create a place that was real to me.
Mm-hmm.
And when the setting becomes real in your mind, then it's much easier to work within it.
A couple more questions about the novel, and then I want to talk about the business of writing.
Mm-hmm.
You leave it on a major cliffhanger.
I wouldn't say that.
Well, there's a pretty big question that goes on. I don't want to talk at all about what it's about.
Sure.
But a lot of the plot strings are resolved. It definitely would stand as its own novel. But there's a final chapter.
I consider
chapter.
It a teaser.
Yeah, it's a final chapter. That's a teaser.
It's not even a chapter. Really, it's probably about 6 paragraphs.
Okay.
At the very end of the book. And I made a point. I think that the book stands on its own. It has a beginning, middle, and an end. There's a resolution of sorts.
Yeah.
There's a feeling of hope at the end, where the book begins in a very hopeless place. And I think that if someone just reads that first book and never picks up another thing that I've written, I think that they will get a whole cohesive story that they can be satisfied with. But I also have a much larger story in mind. And I, at the very end of the book, I give a little taste of where it's going.
Yeah.
And I know that was the one thing that I never revised. That little last section, I wrote that very early on in the first draft.
Mm-hmm.
And it survived to that second draft after I threw all that other stuff away. It survived my agent's edits. It survived my own rewrites. It survived my test readers. It survived my editor. I never changed a word of it. And to this day, I think it's one of the most powerful things in the book.
Yeah, it's post. It is potent.
And hopefully I deliver on it in the sequel.
Without revealing too much, there are characters who we like at the near the end of the book. Are we going to see them? Is there going to be a sequel? And if so, are we going to see those characters again?
Without naming names. There will be somewhere in the vicinity of 4 or 5 books. Okay. It's not a trilogy. Every time someone writes a fantasy series, the word trilogy gets thrown around, right. And this one is no different. I always intended it to be a little bit longer than that, but I have no intention of it being a long, open-ended thing. But I want to finish the series and have it be a complete thing and go on to do other things. I have a lot of ideas for stories. I don't want to be known as just the guy who did this one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The second book will continue the storylines of the main characters from the first book, but it will also introduce some new point of view characters, build up their stories, and show how they thread into the overall story and how these new characters will be every bit as important to the final resolution of things as the ones that we met in the first book. I think I'm spent the last 3 years with these characters, these new characters. I love them every bit as much as the old ones, and I really hope that the readers will like them just as much as I do.
The business of writing. How you mentioned submitting to your agent,
mm-hmm.
which is your present agent. When you first submitted, did you focus on Jabberwocky?
I had met Joshua from Jabberwocky at a Science Fiction Writers of America author's reception. Every year, the Science Fiction Writers of America has a reception in New York. It's affectionately known as the Mill and Swill.
Mm-hmm.
It's very similar to the World Fantasy Convention where we are right now, where it's industry only. Everyone in the room is either an author or an editor or an agent or somehow involved in the publishing business in science fiction and fantasy. A friend of mine, who's actually here at the convention with me, had won the Writers of the Future contest that year,
mm-hmm.
was a member of CIFWA, and invited me along as, you know, his date, as it were. And I met Joshua there at the party, and I told him that I was an aspiring writer, but that I didn't think I was good enough to be submitting my work anywhere. I was still learning and still practicing and still trying to find my voice, and he gave me a long lecture, or you could even say a scolding. He said, "Don't you refuse my books for me, let me refuse them," and told me that it's really difficult to judge your own work, which is true. Writing is a lonely business, and what speaks to the author may not sound the same to the readers. So he pretty much ordered me to send him my book, and I did, and he rejected it. And then I sent him another book that I had written in a completely different setting, completely different world, and he rejected that as well. but upon that second rejection, he called me up and said he wanted to take me out for coffee. We went out to a Starbucks. He sat down with the manuscript that I had just sent him, and went through the whole thing and told me what was wrong with it, and at the end said that I showed a lot of promise, but that it was obvious to him that I had taught myself to write and I hadn't had a lot of formal training, and that I was making some very basic mistakes that I could correct.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me a book on writing called Writing to Sell by Scott Meredith.
Mm-hmm.
Scott Meredith was Joshua's mentor. He ran the Scott Meredith Literary Agency, which... in its day, was the biggest science fiction fantasy agency around. I read that book, and it flipped the light switch on in my head. Suddenly, I saw and understood things about storytelling that I hadn't understood before.
Mm.
And he told me that I should go and take that first book that I sent him, which was the first draft of The Painted Man, and fix it. He said that the concept was good, the storytelling was good, the character was good, and now that I understood those things that I had been missing before, that I should go back and rewrite that book and send it to him again. So I took that to heart. Joshua is a very successful agent and a very busy man, mm-hmm. and I didn't believe that he would take the time to do that if he didn't really mean it.
Yeah, that's extraordinary.
That made me very determined. But at the time, I was doing very well in my career in publishing, and I was recently married and buying my first home, mm-hmm. and I had very little time to write. So I made a decision that I had an hour-long commute to from Brooklyn to Times Square, where I worked at a PR company. And I decided to write during my commute.
Mm-hmm.
So I bought a a smartphone that ran Windows Mobile and had a little version of Microsoft Word. And every day I would get on the train and look for a seat. Sometimes I had to shoulder an old lady aside to do it. But I'd sit down and I'd put my earphones on, drown out the world around me. And for the entire commute, I would sit there with my thumbs and just write.
Wow.
Every day, both ways on the subway and sometimes at lunch, I was writing about 300 to 400 words each way.
Mm-hmm.
And I set a goal of myself for 1,000 words a day. So I would write approximately 800 words during my commute and at lunch, and then I would come home and fix the numerous typos from typing with my thumbs. I would sync the file back to my main computer, fix all the typos, and then write however much I needed to reach that 1,000 words. I did that for about a year. Wrote that missing 60% of the book that I had cut out of the first draft. Most of that was written on my phone with my thumbs during my commute. And because that was the only time I had.
Right.
And the rest is history. In some circles, I'm actually more famous for that than for the book itself. There are a lot of technology blogs got a hold of that story, and even the New York Daily News had it on page 3 when the book came out. That, you know, man writes book on subway on his smartphone, and Laptop Magazine did an interview with me and the Boy Genius Report, and so I've seen the story translated into over a dozen languages all over the world. Man writes book on his phone. far more people have read that story than have read the book.
That's wild. Quite a bit of free publicity, though.
Yeah, it was. And the thing is that it was never, I didn't do it for publicity. I did it out of necessity. I needed to find time to write. I didn't have any other time. And so I did what I had to do. And at the time, it didn't occur to me that I was doing something all that special, but apparently other people thought it was.
That's wild. We only have a couple more minutes left. What's your next project coming up?
I actually have several projects that I'm working on right now. I have a small book of short stories set in the same world called The Great Bazaar that's mm-hmm. coming out from Subterranean Press in January. It's a limited edition small hardcover run. It's only about 1,200 copies.
Undoubtedly beautiful, because that's what they do.
It's a wonderful piece. 200 of them will be signed and numbered. The other 1,000 will just be the regular beautiful edition.
Mm-hmm.
That short story was meant to be a primer for someone who has never read the series. It introduces the world and the concept in a way that if you've never read anything else of mine, you can read that and mm-hmm. have a taste. It's also meant to fill in a gap that's in the first book mm-hmm. that I just couldn't afford to add another 15,000 words to the manuscript. So there was a little scene that I thought was very important to the story that I just never had time to write
mm-hmm.
or never had space to write. So I it's a nice addition to the story for someone who enjoyed the first book. And it's also set in the desert city of Fort Crasia, which is where much of the second book will take place.
Wow.
So it's a good introduction lead into the new book. The new book is known as The Desert Spear. It will be on sale in April 2010. It's finished. It's copy edited. It's done. It's out of my hands. So, barring some incredible natural disaster, it will be out on time. So, no worries on that regard.
Sweet.
It's 240,000 words, so it should be a nice, satisfying read for everyone.
That's awesome.
It was an extremely difficult book to write, but looking back on it, I am incredibly proud of it. I think it's the best thing I've ever done.
Wow.
And I really hope that other people feel the same way about it. I also will be including another novella set in the same world for the Subterranean Tales of Dark Fantasy 2, which will be coming out sometime in 2010. I don't know exactly when. They haven't set a date for it. But the story is done. So whenever that comes out, that'll be in there as well. So 2010 is a big year for me.
I'll say. Yeah. Do you have any words for aspiring authors?
Well, I think that my story is not a unique one. I think that if you talk to any published writer, I've been hanging out with Brent Weeks all weekend. He said the same thing, and Ken Scholes, just about everyone else, is that writing is something you need to not give up on. It's a hard road. It's both difficult both to write something that's good enough, but it's also you have to have a thick skin. You have to be prepared for some rejection. You have to be prepared to keep going. You have to be prepared to write another book if the one you write people don't like it, and you have to be prepared to realize that you're not in it for the money, because writing isn't the most lucrative of businesses. I mean, even with the success I've had, the most successful fantasy writers still make less than the average New York guy who wears a suit. But that said, if you really want it and you really have that drive, don't give up. Keep at it, and make sure that whatever you hand in is the absolute best thing that you can do, and that's all you can really do.
Cool. Thank you very much.
Sure.
This has been an interview with Peter V. Brett, author of The Warded Man. If you haven't read it yet, buy it, get it from the library, download it on your Kindle, whatever, because it is great.
Thank you.
We are here at World Fantasy with John Sprunk.
Hello.
I believe your novel's coming out in next year, is that correct?
Yeah, June 2010.
Okay, and what's it called?
Give me the Shadow title. Sun.
Fantasy?
S-O-N, yes, fantasy. I guess they classify it as epic. I think of it more as dark or, not quite gothic, but more of a darker fantasy, yeah.
We were having a debate, some of my friends and I, last night about exactly the categorizations of high fantasy versus epic versus dark. And it seems that everybody's pretty much ambiguous on what exactly they are.
I think we share so many elements, like sword and sorcery. Where does that stop, and where does epic start, and high fantasy? Is that just the language you use? If you use a lot of these and thous, yeah. Are you now into high? So I think it's such a hodgepodge that... Yeah, it's all one big thing to me. I don't really classify myself. You're right, but you're right, and the bookstore has to sell it somehow. You know what I mean?
So, dark fantasy. Give me the pitch. That's the skin.
Oh, it's just been so long since I pitched it.
It doesn't have to be formal.
It's about a freelance assassin.
Yeah.
Who is like a lone wolf kind of guy, and he one of his jobs goes bad, and he finds himself on the run, not just from the law, but from other assassins after him, and then there's some sorcery wrapped up, and so it's sort of like a Bourne Identity meets pick your favorite fantasy book.
Right on. What got you into writing?
Oh, I've been writing for as long as I can remember.
You're one of those, like, in kindergarten, you're like, I wrote my first short story.
I think second grade, I actually, my first real writing attempt at a book report, instead of reporting on the book, I actually rewrote the ending and got in trouble for it. You know,
expensive.
Yeah. But I guess wanting to do it as a profession or at least as a serious hobby probably started in like junior high, because I've been reading for so long, and I guess at some point I wanted to make up my own stories to go along with what I've been reading. So, and you know, just I've always had the dream of it, and it's just recently become reality. I could do it for, you know, professional.
Did you pursue an education in it, or is it mostly just winging it?
I have a BA in English from Lock Haven University.
That would be a yes.
Yes. And even back then, it was still a dream phase, you know what I mean? And there's always a 9-to-5 job to pay the bills. But yeah, you keep working at it, and don't give up too soon.
So what got you? You were reading in second grade then, and writing also?
I guess. That's the first time I remember writing something fictional for a real result, you know what I mean?
What was what kind of stuff were you reading in second
grade? Oh, wow, I can't remember. My dad had a pretty good library, you know, so I would just go and pick whatever, you know, pick up things off his library. Okay. I think my first fantasy was something called Kothar and the Wizard Slayer,
goodness.
I forget the author, but I could never find any more books by this guy, and it was so awesome. And then The Hobbit, you know what I mean? Tried Lord of the Rings early, but it was so dense I could never get through it as a grade schooler.
Oh my gosh.
But you know, and then anything, science fiction, you know, robot stories, spaceship stories,
Asimov.
Yeah, you know, the easier stuff, right. Not the heavy stuff right back then. But you know, I've always had a book in my hand, it seems like.
That's rad. Yeah, I didn't actually start reading until I was about in my 20s. Seriously, so
okay.
I'm kinda envious.
A latecomer.
Yeah. It's like I hear stories about people who've started writing in the second grade, and I'm like, you.
It's not really quite that cool. It's more like, like I said, it was for a school assignment. I got in trouble for it anyway, but, you know.
No, they said in that movie Finding Forrester, that's how they said to learn to write. You know, he gave them the sample paragraph and just kind of pick it up when you feel.
Yeah, when you feel like you have something to say of your very own, yeah.
Your teacher actually got mad at you for...
Well, it was a book report about this book. It wasn't like mad at, you know, second grade, how mad did they get at you? I remember, like, all the kids had, like, you know, this book is about this and this, and I'm like, I just pick up where I left off and kept... They're like, what was the point of the whole
thing? And she knew the book.
Yeah. Well, so, we all, it was the same book for everybody, so... Okay. Yeah, I was busted.
But, it's like, that's not how it ended.
It is what it is.
That's cool. So, rural Pennsylvania, you said?
Well...
Central Pennsylvania.
Right, suburbs of Harrisburg, okay. Yeah, it's not quite rural, but, you know, Central Pennsylvania does in some parts get pretty, you know, farmland still, so...
That lend itself to writing?
I don't think it hurts or helps either way, really, I mean...
A lot of writers dream of, you know, the great cabin in the woods where they can write in the peace and quiet without the bustle of the city.
I like restaurants and malls and movie theaters too much, you know, if I can't see a movie once in a while, I go crazy, so... Mm. No, I like to be right in the suburbs. You know, you can always take a drive out in the country if you want to, but 5 minutes away is all the restaurants you could want. And
so do you write in coffee shops or...
No, just at home.
Okay.
It's just that we have a den, my computer. It's nothing special about it, you know.
Any particular... do you use PC or Mac?
PC.
What's some good writing software for... Is it Word or is it...
Yeah, I just use MS Word.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing...
Nothing fancy.
No, it's just got to work. It's just got to put your stuff down. So, I used to use a typewriter back in college. I had one of those electric typewriters, and you know, you get sick of using the whiteout. So eventually, it's by computer. And you know.
So how long were you working on your novel before
Shadow Sun?
Yeah, give me how did you meet the hook up with Jabberwocky?
Okay, it's my fourth novel I've ever written. My first sale, though.
Uh-huh.
I started it probably about, I don't know, a year and a half ago. Took me about 6 months to write it. And then I started sending out different agents, mostly a couple publishers, but mostly agents, and got a lot of rejections, which was awesome for my self-esteem. And then, I shouldn't probably tell this whole story. I'm not really supposed to, but I'm good anyway. This is posterity, right? I got
on the
lucky.
Internet, man. It never disappears.
I got real lucky. Peer Books is an agent-only submission place. Mm-hmm. Any authors out there, please don't do this. But I decided, you know what the heck? I sent them anyway a submission. And I got lucky, I guess. I hit the exact right day when the publisher had nothing else to do. Said, I'll take a look. And he gave me a call and said, I want to see more. And he actually, wow. Lou Anders, the publisher of
Pyre,
their fantasy section, he actually suggested Jabberwocky for me. Because I didn't have an agent at that point. And he asked me, who are you thinking about? And I told him a few names that people I had met at conferences. And he said, you know what? I want you to talk to these guys, Joshua and Eddie. And he actually called for me.
Hmm. Oh,
and then,
sweet.
And then they called me at home, and we chatted, and they read the book, and they liked it too, and we made it official.
That is wild.
So the official version I tell people is that, you know, I talked to Eddie first, and he sold it to Pyre, but the truth is the other way around. So
yeah, no, that's good to know. I mean, I was having a conversation with David G. Hartwell last night,
mm-hmm.
and the woman I was chatting with, she and I were chatting with him, and she had the courage to pitch to him.
Oh, really?
And I'm like, I don't have that kind of courage. Where did you sum up that, or is it just, did you know better at the time and you just did it anyway?
Nah, cause I've written 4 books and a lot of short stories. I've been pitching at conventions, okay. and via email and in the mail, snail mail, for so long. When you get more than 100 rejections under your belt, you really stop caring what people are going to say no about. You just say, if you don't keep sending it out, you won't ever get the yes.
That's
and
true.
You know, I think you get to a point as a writer where you start to realize, okay, what I'm writing is as good or better than what I read in the bookstores.
Yeah, and then the proof is that you got Lou Anders to recommend you.
Well, you know, if that's proof or not, we'll see. It's up to the reader still, but...
Yeah, but I mean, that's like, they say it's a needle in a haystack sifting through the slush pile, the horrors and torrents of pages they get.
I think it's crapshoot in some ways. You know, I think it's a lot of luck plays into it. I think, you know, you get... Let's keep submitting because, you know, you want to be that needle, but you have to keep putting yourself out there to do it.
Now, what about the other 3 novels? You don't have to go into detail.
One I wrote during college. It's horrible, horrible, horrible stuff. I read it afterwards, and it made me cry so bad. But that is probably the novel's most personal to me, so someday I will go back for that. The other two, I've read, you know, probably I wrote in the last maybe 4 or 5 years, so they're still reasonably current, and I think after the Shadow series plays mm-hmm. out, I'll probably go back and see if I can collect anything worthwhile out of them.
That's
whether
cool.
it's a rewrite or just mm-hmm. take some good ideas and totally redo it, but they're still there for, you know, you might see them someday, but you never know.
Yeah. Shadow Sun. How many words did that end up with? You said 6 months.
Yeah, it's probably right around 100,000.
Okay. So you're not like 300,000 Tad Williams tomes.
Nah, you know, I never wrote something that long before, the 300,000 whatever, you know, get to the Harry Potter things, and I guess I just tell a story and try and get out, you know, before I use up my welcome.
Yeah, how did you decide when you were done? Is it just, that's, it wasn't, it obviously wasn't a word count.
No,
I just
wrote until the story ended for me, you know, and I'm not sure how to explain it. It's just a certain point you get to, and it's like, yeah, that's, the story's over. He wins in the end, and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And how much do you say after that? I mean, you could, I guess, add 3 or 4 more chapters of home life afterwards,
right.
but no one's read that crap anyway,
right.
you know.
The 3 endings of the Hobbit.
Yeah, don't look at that stuff, yeah, unfortunately.
Did you find that writing was the best education in learning to write better? I mean,
yeah.
Yeah, just draft after draft, or 3-4 novels.
Yeah, you just have to keep at it. I had the English BA. You know, I had some creative writing classes in there, but mostly it was just about pumping up short stories for class. You know, I think that's
mm-hmm.
that's your education. You just keep writing and reading too. I mean, if you don't know what's out there, you really don't have a good idea of what could be new and fresh
right.
and exciting for anybody else. So. You read first, and then you write, and you write, and you write, and I think there's no shortcuts to that.
Mm.
You know, you read about people that are, you know, their first book attempt sells and is a bestseller, and,
yeah.
you know, it's God bless them or whatever, but that's not me. That's
that's wild. So, you said you have a series in mind.
Yeah, well, for Shadow Sun, it's a 3-book trilogy.
Okay.
Shadow Sun, Shadow's Lore, and Shadow's Master, they all follow the same title character through his overarching adventure, and then that wraps him up, and then we're on to something else.
The same assassin character.
Yeah, yeah, Kame. Yep.
So he doesn't die at the end.
Spoiler!
Spoiler alert, he does not die at the end, although you might think he does for a bit. Actually it was not supposed to be a standalone. I wrote it with only the first book really in mind.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because like I said, you write a few books and get rejected and you don't set yourself up mentally to get a whole project. You know what I mean? It's easier just to write one and keep moving. So, but when I talked to Lou, one of his first questions was, do you have more for this character? And I said, oh, sure.
Why, yes, I do.
Of course I do. If you want to buy more, I definitely will sell you more. So then I had to scramble, you know, and decide what happens next for the character. And luckily, I had some in the back of my mind, some ideas where it could have gone. So I just kind of fleshed them out a little bit, and that's what I'm working on next.
Cool. So it's not a French tragedy where everyone's dead.
I tried that with my first book, and everybody hated the idea of it, so I stopped doing that.
So did you, with your first novels, did you submitted them as well?
Oh, yeah. Yep, I was, 20 years old when I finished my first novel and sent it around every place. And back then, that was probably, 20 years ago, so there's a lot more places to send it to. Fantasy has kind of shrunk to a few publishers now.
Mm.
So, yeah, you send them out to everybody, all the agents you can think of, you can find online, and... guess that's why it's sort of it's a luck thing, because I'm sure some of the stuff I wrote a few years ago wasn't horrible. It's just it has to connect with that editor or that agent
right.
on that particular day, and it's discouraging sometimes, but it's...
I like how you said some of the stuff I sent out wasn't horrible.
No. I'm sure some of the stuff I was. I mean,
yeah.
I've been turned down for stuff I wrote that I knew afterwards and I should have submitted. That wasn't ready yet.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But other stuff was... as good as what I write now. So
how did you come to the point of knowing that your own stuff, like there's the kind of person who's like, I love everything I write, and then there's the guy who says, I hate everything I write.
I heard somebody say, or I read it somewhere, I forget who, you should think that you're writing the best stuff ever as you're writing, and when you're editing, think it's the worst thing that was ever written by anybody, and then when you send it out, have that confidence again, think it's great. You know, I mean, so it's sort of a bipolar thing, but I guess it's mostly by reading. And I read a lot, and my wife does also, and we trade books. And I know there's a lot. When you start reading stuff, that you're like, you know what, I'm doing better than this. Why aren't I published?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But it's not personal. It's just it's a luck thing. You gotta find the editor who wants that story on that day.
Mm-hmm.
And I got lucky. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, luck, destiny, whatever.
I'll take that,
too. It's fantasy. We can include these.
Sure. Fate is prophesied, right?
That's right. Do you now, you mentioned you wrote the draft, and then, like you said, the first time you read it, you have to think that you're awesome.
Mm-hmm.
The second time, you have to think that you're...
horrible.
So, did you go through multiple drafts? How many drafts did you go through?
Well, I probably only went through two before I submitted it around. And you write it, and then I rewrote it. And usually in the past, I've done something where I'll take a book and I'll revise it 2, 3, 4, 5 times even.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what I was doing was I was sucking the life out of it. You know what I mean? You get so paranoid about every word you put down and, are you saying exactly what you want to say? And I think... if you rewrite too many times, you can get to the point where you end up with a very dry text. And so this time I didn't do that. I just wrote it, rewrote it once to get the worst of the mistakes out, send it off. And then, of course, once they accept something, you go through their hoops,
uh-huh.
which are their rewrites. And
so they did have a lot of critiques?
No, Lou did not. Lou had a few points of things which we definitely correct on. There's a plot hole here. This character could be beefed up or toned down, whatever. Mm-hmm. But they're not too bad. Eddie Snyder, my major agent, he had a lot more. He was like, it's already sold. You don't have to do this. But I really think you should do a few more things. And he had a laundry list that I went through very carefully. And he's real sharp.
Yeah.
He seems prodigious. He picked out some things, line by line, graph by graph, that was like, wow, you're right. I am, I do that too often. I got to change up a little bit. He's meticulous. But that's,
yeah.
So I liked it because I think that we, between him, Lou, and I, we produced a better book than I could have done by myself.
So there wasn't that many critiques.
Not really.
I've read on their websites that they're really, I mean, they describe basically the situation that they go, that they're interested in doing, kind of building an author's career,
mm-hmm.
rather than you've sold it, I want part of your money, now go away.
Yeah. No, they're really good, but I think, you know, I've been writing for a while. I think if I can be a little above myself, I think I sent them a pretty good manuscript from the start, and it's mm-hmm. not because it's my first attempt, you know, it's my whatever attempt, and all the novellas I'm including in that, all the short stories that were crap, you know, so it was pretty polished when it sent. I think that's the thing today. I mean, 20 years ago, you could send an unpolished manuscript to an agent or a publisher, and they would give you, they'd work with it, you know what I mean, mm-hmm. it'd mold you with it, but nowadays, I think that they want something they could sell almost tomorrow if they had, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah,
because they don't have the budget anymore to have a huge staff to go over it so much, and you know, things are tighter all the way around. So it's tougher on us as a writer. You have to have something almost perfect, I think, to get it. Not that it was perfect. I'm just saying that whatever.
Right.
But you
polished,
know,
at least.
I think it was pretty good. And you know,
there's that third part again.
Yeah,
you got to think it's awesome when you send it out.
You have to, otherwise you won't do it. I mean, so many times you get to that stage, you're like, well, either you mail it out to those guys and take a chance, or you just sit in your basement and
you're
only
guy.
You enjoy it.
Yeah,
yeah.
You and your wife are the only ones who know it exists.
But that's not so bad. Actually, I write for her, so
hey, if it makes her happy, man.
She's my first reader, and
awesome.
I always said that if only she ever reads my stuff, I'm still going to die a happy guy. I mean, don't get me wrong. I want the world to see it, but you know, she's the inspiration behind, you know, the career in the first place.
That's rad. Yeah, that's supportive spouse is amazing.
Oh, it's everything. Because I can't imagine if she didn't read.
Yeah.
You know, if she thought books were crap, I don't know what I would do. I probably was. I wouldn't be sitting right here. Probably.
So some authors think that the art of the short story and the art of the novel are divergent sufficiently that you really have to specialize in one. Or that you have to build up both skills. That there's and others, you find that in their writing, their stories are constructed at the pace of a short story.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you fall in that camp?
I'm definitely a novelist. Even when I was younger, I just was tripping over myself to start working on my first projects. It was always longer stuff I was interested in. You know, my first serious attempt at any writing beyond really bad poetry to impress girls was a novel, you know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And so I think it's more of a preference thing, you know. I'm just built that way. I like a longer structure. When I try to write short stories, of which I have a couple published and small things, you know, and I've written a few haven't been published, even they tend to be a longer side of the short story, you know, format, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I can't do 2,000 words.
Huh.
I mean, I don't know what that looks
yeah.
like in my head.
Twitter fiction's out.
Yeah, I mean, I can read it and appreciate it, but when I set a story character down, I guess my mind starts to say, okay, he can do this and that and this and that, and before you know it, I've got 15,000, 20,000 words going,
novella.
No one's
going
to buy this,
right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, the novella market's booming right now.
Yeah, well.
So, did you find that the study or even the pursuit of short stories helped your ability to plot?
Definitely. I'm not sure plotting-wise so much, but I learned a lot about, you know, that stick and move. You know what I mean? Say what you have to say and then move on. You know, I think as a novelist, what I used to do way back in the day, and I might still do it, who knows, is you get wordy. You
mm-hmm.
know, you get those 3,000, 100,000 pages, whatever. You know, you want to describe a scene. If you can do it one paragraph, you know, don't take 4 pages. You know,
right.
You're just boring everybody who's reading it. So that's why I learned most about from short stories. No, say what you got to say. Say it briefly. Say it clearly, and move on.
So there's along the same lines. There's a concept called in media res, where
in the middle of things.
Yeah, in the middle of things, where you just kind of drop the reader in and assume that they're going to pick it up as they walk. You know, like you're walking down the city street, eventually figure out it's a city when you look at the high buildings. You know what I'm saying?
Sink or swim. Yeah.
Right.
I don't know. I think.
Do you lean in that, or are you?
I don't think about either way. I mean,
just whatever flows.
Yeah, I mean, for the start of a novel, maybe a little bit, because you want to sort of get something moving right away to hook the reader in,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean? And then you sort of give some explanation, but you know, different chapter beginnings will be different. You know, I don't want to start every chapter the same way, you know, a fish fight or whatever. It gets very boring. So one chapter might start with the description of a scene, one might start with dialogue, one might start with a fight, one might start with, you know, anything. So I mix up a little bit.
And is that deliberate pacing?
Yeah,
is that just
definitely deliberate?
Story,
yeah, you
really.
That's how I tell it. You know, keep it interesting.
How did you develop this sense of pacing?
I have no idea.
Is it the BA in studying?
No, it's not. It's the BS in whatever. No, I think it's just something you pick up. At least I have.
Yeah,
you know,
just in prolific reading.
When you write and you can, you know, you write five or six chapters and you can read back over them and you say, okay, every chapter or every scene even starts with the same thing. It was a nice day and it's raining or it's sunny and you're okay, enough weather.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
That's okay for one chapter now. Anything else has to go. Move it up, move it back. And, you know, it's just a...
No weather, no guys looking in the mirror.
I'm not saying don't ever do it. I'm just saying don't do it every chapter,
right,
or every scene. You
right.
know what I mean? So it's a feeling. You know, how does a dancer know? You know how to make up steps? You just
right.
you do it over and over, and something clicks, and you're like, hey, that's kind of cool. And
so there are the writing instructors who or just people who speak on the craft that say you have to write a million words.
I've heard this.
And there's another sect that say you can't master something until you've been doing it for 10 years. But you've won Pyre Books, so how do you feel about those?
Well, I do fall in a stereotype. I've been writing, you know, as a serious hobby / profession for 20 years.
Okay.
So for me, it took a long time to get to the point where I was ready to be published. And I'm sure I've written at least a million words before I wrote Shadow Sun. So I am the stereotype in some
right.
way. But I don't think you have to. I think there's people more talented than I am that could take a third of that time or less. You know what I mean? It's
now, in podcasting, a lot of the podcasters are also authors. A lot of the reasons that they podcast, and I'm speaking obviously generically, not
mm-hmm.
specifically, but is to market. Do you have a marketing, or is it kind of like, and not saying that this is required, because I spoke with
sure.
One of the major buyers who said the best marketing is just write the best book you can. But the industry is such as it is.
Yeah, I wish I could believe that, but everything I read and hear from other authors and, you know, Eddie and Josh and even from Lou, the publisher, is sort of, it's not always enough anymore just to do that. I mean, some writers can get away with that. You know, Stephen King can write a book and then never promote it anywhere, and it's still going to be fine.
Yeah,
he's got that name built. But for new authors, it's very difficult to get, you know, to make an audience, because
mm-hmm.
there's so much out there, so much, you know, white noise going
right.
on in the background. You have to, you know, well, how much will I do? I don't really know yet. A little bit, at least.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not a super extroverted kind of guy.
Yeah.
I don't walk up to strangers easily and say, my name is John Sprunk, here's my book, would you want to read it?
You had the courage to send out.
Right, yeah. Just, you know, it's easier or through a letter or through an email. It's, the rejection doesn't come, you know, face-to-face so much. But I think it's just, you know, as far as promotion, yeah, I think it's part of the job these days. At least a little bit. And podcasts, you know, book signings, readings, dressing up and go to the Renaissance Fair, and, you know, whatever you have to do to get
yeah.
your audience. And hopefully the dream is to have the audience so big and so diverse, just write the great books and
yeah.
they still come. And then
yeah.
when you show up at some book signing, it's like, you know, a million people, and it's like you're a rock star. And that's,
yeah.
you know.
I had the privilege of meeting Robert Jordan
mm.
a few months before he died at a Barnes & Noble. The line was around the building.
Madhouse, huh?
Yeah, it was crazy. My wife and I just decided we didn't want a chair and stood on the side so we didn't have to wait in line. But
yeah, it's so sad how
yeah.
he's passed, you know, way before his time and
yeah.
before his big epic opus was even complete. That's
Sanderson's picking it up. And
yeah.
from what I read of his, he's competent.
Yeah, I'm going to pick it up. I'm going to read it. And I'm going to, you know, miss Mr. Jordan. And too bad he can't be able to enjoy the success
mm-hmm.
he's now.
Is there we're about out of time. Is there anything that you wish I had asked that I didn't?
We've covered a lot of stuff today. No, you'd be great, man.
Any last advice for writers?
Oh,
if you could sum it up in a sentence or a paragraph.
Don't give up, you know. Read everything you can get your hands on. Write every day if you can. And don't give up. That's it. It's as easy as that.
Sweet. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing. Please visit our website at adventuresinscifipublishing.com for online interviews, book reviews, news stories, coverage of live events, videos, and much more. You can send us an email at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com and give us a call at 206-350-5029. Music by Cargo Colt from their track Dirt, available at magnatune.com. You've been listening to a Singularity Audio production. To learn more, please visit www.singularityaudio.com.